Good afternoon and welcome to Transformational Women Radio. This is your host, Hannah Anam. We interview women who are transforming their businesses, teams, and communities, and we get their nuggets about how they create this transformational change around them. There's really four key traits that differentiate transformational leaders. They're incredibly purpose-driven. They're innovative change agents. They know how to deeply engage others, and they're inspiring in terms of their clarity and their values. And today we have an amazing woman that is joining us today, Alicia Philip. Alicia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to read a little bit, Alicia, from your bio because you've got an incredibly impressive background. Alicia is the president of the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta, one of the largest and fastest growing philanthropic service organizations in the country. With over $740 million in assets, the Community Foundation strengthens the 23-county Atlanta region by providing quality services to donors and innovative leadership on community issues. Your local, regional, and national leadership responsibilities include previous service as a board member of the Council on Foundations, the Southeastern Council on Foundations, and obviously various others. You have received lots of neat honors. I'm going to read from some of them. They include being named one of the 100 more influential Atlantans by the Atlanta Business Chronicle and one of 175 Emory History Makers by Emory University. So welcome to the show. And I know that you have lots of good stories to tell, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of your stories. So, why don't we get started? Tell us about the business that you're in and how you got here.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Hannah, very much for having me here today. This is really fun. I love to have conversations like this, but I've been very fortunate to be at the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta for 35 years, which is kind of unusual in today's terms, somebody being at one place. But briefly, the Community Foundation is a philanthropic resource organization, but we have four main focuses. One is engaging donors, is helping people, as we like to say, become raging philanthropists, so that donors, when they set up funds in the foundation, can learn about the community and they can learn about how to do family philanthropy even better. We're there to strengthen nonprofits, so we have a number of different ways that we provide both general operating support grants and other kinds of supports to help nonprofits be strong. The third is advancing public will, because on some issues, all the money in the world isn't going to really make a difference. You have to look at issues around public policy and how to change systems to make a difference. And the fourth is practicing organizational excellence. We want to be an excellent organization and be a model in the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. So that's briefly just so that people have a sense. And the Community Foundation, as you mentioned, it has about $740 million in assets and has been around for 60 years. So it's quite an Atlanta institution.
Mm-hmm. And you're quite the Atlanta institution as well, having been with the foundation, I guess, very early on, obviously, since its inception and leading it.
Well, it was about 25 years old when I came, and it had two previous presidents. Mm-hmm. So I was the third one. But I hit it at the perfect time. The tax law was changing in a way that really made it easier for living donors to make gifts to the Community Foundation. And so I hit the ground running. I was mm-hmm. extremely fortunate, and I had excellent board of directors mm-hmm. who really were connected to this community.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about your personal history. I'm curious about your background. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what caused you to get involved in the foundation. This early, it was obviously very early in your career.
It was. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, outside of Baltimore, Maryland, and went to high school there and then did my first 2 years of college at an all-women's Catholic college in Washington, D.C., but it closed down in my sophomore years. Many women's colleges closed during their mid-70s. So I transferred to Emory University. Did my last 2 years of college there. I wanted to go to a college that wasn't going to close, and Emory wasn't about to close.
That's good.
And when I graduated from Emory, it was 1975, and it was an extremely difficult time, much like it is now, in that there was a significant real estate crisis that particularly hit Atlanta hard, and I wanted to stay here, and there were very few jobs. Mm-hmm. So I went and applied under a program called the CETA program for hardcore unemployed. Mm-hmm. And some nonprofit organizations were able to select from that pool of applicants to choose people. And mm-hmm. Central Atlanta Progress and mm-hmm. Dan Sweat was one of those. And I was chosen, went to work there at 20, 2 years old. Mm-hmm. At 23, the job with the Community Foundation came open, and Dan Sweat was chair of the board, and I said, yes, I can do this. Mm-hmm. Please, please, please. And they gave me a chance. And
so at the age of ripe old age of 23, you became the president.
And only staff person. I mean, I was chief cook and bottle washer. Yeah.
Of the Atlanta Foundation, Community Foundation. So tell us about how big it was beyond the number of employees and
Zero employees and $4
million. $4
million. Wow. So it was an interesting opportunity because I had to do all the different jobs. So I went back, got an MBA at Georgia State during that time because quickly realized that both marketing and finance skills were going to be incredibly important if this is the work that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Those early years were interesting, too. If you think about being a 23-year-old woman working with almost all 60-year-old white men. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
And these were the guys that were on the board.
They were on the board, and they were, you know, that's who really sort of controlled the resources and the assets. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, the concept of women donors mm-hmm. wasn't really that prevalent when you think about that. You know, that mid-70s, mm-hmm, late 70s period of time, that whole movement hadn't really been. I mean, it was the men who made the money and the men who controlled the money, both philanthropically and in all different phases. So approaching them to ask them to set up funds in the foundation and to sort of do that was a challenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a significant challenge.
What did you learn about yourself early in your career? I mean, you're absolutely right. Just that challenge of how do you get credibility really fast when you ask people for money? How do you have the confidence to ask people for money?
I think I borrowed the credibility from Dan Sweat, who stayed as the board chair. So, I mean, and the board. So I think I borrowed some of their credibility. I also think it was a very interesting thing. I think many of those men looked at me and saw in me their daughter. And I think many of them wanted their daughter to have a better world and to be part of the business community. And I think many of them were willing to give me a chance in a different way than a previous generation, even to that, would not have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. And what did you learn about yourself?
I learned that you have to work very, very hard, that you have to have a vision. I had both a personal vision and a vision for the foundation. I had a little 3x5 card that I had in my desk drawer about where I wanted to be in 5 years, you know, these 5-year goals. And so I think it's important to set goals, even if they are big, hairy, audacious goals, and to be able to look at those and to see how you're doing.
So tell me, what did that 3x5 card say?
Well, the 3x5 card said that I was going to build the Community Foundation to 100. It was a personal goal and a professional goal, that I was going to build it to $100 million. So you can imagine it, $4 million, $100 million
seems
like
definitely a BHAG, yes.
It was. And, you know, we got there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't get there quite in the 5 years, mm-hmm. but, I mean, we eventually got to the $100 million. But it was a big goal.
Mm-hmm. It was. I remember reading a quote, it was maybe from Eleanor Roosevelt, that said, you know, the future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. I'm sure I'm botching it up, but it's something that stuck with me, and it really talks to the power of dreaming.
Yes.
And clearly you had a nice dream. So tell me, so other than the fact, obviously, that, you know, you started in this organization at a point where you were unemployed.
Exactly.
And that you were willing to take whatever came along, it sounded like. But obviously, you've stayed in the organization in the face of lots and lots of opportunities in front of you that have probably, you know, surfaced since. Tell me a little bit about what is it that causes you to continue to stay in the organization and to serve in the role that you've stayed in.
I think there are two things. One is, I think that if you are potted into very fertile soil, your roots go down deep. And sometimes it's not only hard to leave, you feel you're stronger by staying there and keeping your roots growing. And I feel like for me, the Community Foundation was the most incredible fertile soil that I could have imagined, that I could have wound up being potted in, because it is unlimited opportunity. The Community Foundation really can do anything. you know, legal, moral, ethical, mm-hmm. nonprofit. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it can go in many different ways to serve this community. So the opportunity to change and grow with the community were always there. I think the second reason is that every day is a new day. Because of that flexibility and the ability to innovate constantly, there's always the opportunity, what's the next thing that we could do that could really make a difference for this community? Above and beyond being the best we can be at helping donors to give, being the best we can be at strengthening nonprofits, what are those things we can do that would even like exponentially take this community to the next level?
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about that. What are some of the bold goals that you're setting for yourself, for the organization? What is that next big exponential, big, hairy, audacious dream that you've got?
I guess there's two. One is that I think that the Community Foundation, and it's not just about amassing money, so please don't take it that way, but I think this community needs a resource that's constantly growing because the needs in this community are constantly growing. So it's really about meeting needs. It's not about how big can we get.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, we ought to be a $1 billion community foundation, and that ought to happen in the relatively near future. Mm-hmm. So that's a big goal.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is a program that we're working on that I just think is so exciting and interesting. What we're calling it at the moment is the Atlanta Wealth Building Initiative, but it's the concept of creating a for-profit business in a low-income neighborhood that will employ people who live in that neighborhood, many of whom may have criminal records, to perform a business and sell the product to people like anchor institutions like Emory and others, and the workers will own the business. It'll be a cooperatively owned business.
Mm-hmm.
It gets at the goals of employment. It gets at the goals of rebuilding neighborhoods. It gets at the goals of wealth building, which is more than just people having minimum wage jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's something that has not been done in the state of Georgia. And we really need to keep trying new ideas and new ways of looking at things about how we get at all of those aspects.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually a social entrepreneurship venture.
Yes.
Excellent,
yes.
Excellent.
And we will just sort of launch and get started. It won't be ours.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the Community Foundation often plays that incubator role.
Mm-hmm.
We created and spun off the Georgia Center for Nonprofits, created and spun off the Atlanta Women's Foundation. So it's not always about all these things staying with us, but it's about figuring out what the community needs and then helping that to get leveraged
mm-hmm.
and out there.
Mm-hmm. So that's a really neat idea, which is to basically incubate social businesses
mm-hmm.
that help, obviously, the owners of those businesses, the entrepreneurs, but also help the communities in which that they live and serve. What are some examples of perhaps something like that you've invested in? Or
we haven't yet. So,
okay.
I mean, this first business that we're looking at that we will be doing the business planning around and business modeling and then hopefully actually break ground in early 2013, it will probably be a massive greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Producing upwards of 3 million heads of lettuce a year and having next to it a food processing plant to be able to take that lettuce and put it into bags and have it salad ready for institutions like Emory or other institutions that would be able to buy that.
Mm-hmm.
All of which would produce about maybe between 100 or 150 jobs in that community,
mm-hmm.
jobs that are never going to leave that community.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Are you familiar with the Acumen Fund?
Yes, very much so.
And so Acumen Fund is obviously doing a lot of that. Jacqueline Novogratz mm-hmm. Is doing a lot of that in the developing world space. What are some challenges? You talked about a couple of big, hairy, audacious goals, one being the $1 billion fund and the other being really incubating these social businesses. What are some challenges that you see for you, for the organization, as you, set your sights on achieving these goals? What are some of the biggest challenges that you face?
Some of the challenges are ones that are very hard for us to do anything about, and that is, the changing tax code.
Mm-hmm.
What will the tax situation be for charitable contributions? That's
mm-hmm.
a difficult one to figure out, and
mm-hmm.
it's a difficult – we don't know what the answer will be.
Mm-hmm.
Not that taxes determine how much people give, but it does determine how much they give.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that big question, and we are in such, as you know, I mean, the whole nation's in a state of flux around what taxes should
mm-hmm.
be, what should be taxed or not. And I think the other thing is that, you know, Atlanta, the metropolitan area, I like to think of it as being ready for its second great act.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of the social businesses and other things, I think, are part of that second act. But there's a lot of other pieces to that second act that other people are working on, transportation, the Beltline. All of these have to fit together to make it all work as well as it can be. So I'm just hoping that all the pieces come together in this second act for Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. How about you personally? What are some leadership challenges as you've, I'm sure the organization has, you're no longer the chief bottle washer in the organization. So
goodness.
The organization has expanded. You know, as you think about your own personal leadership, what are some of the challenges that you see going forward, or what are some goals that you're setting for yourself?
Well, I hope that none of my staff are listening, actually, because what's so interesting is, you know, having gone from being able to do all those jobs, I don't know that I could do one job that that one of the 30 staff people at the foundation does. They are very, you know, very sophisticated and complicated jobs, and it's a phenomenal staff at the Community Foundation, extraordinarily talented people that really know how to do the work they do. And it's a challenge to keep, you know, as always, it is any business or any nonprofit to keep people motivated. But these are people who care deeply about this community and who really want to make a difference. They could make more money going somewhere else, but they couldn't make the difference that they're making by being here.
Mm-hmm.
So constantly keeping them motivated, building trust, building that vision, and making sure that everyone understands what their part in that vision is, I think is always a continuing challenge for any person.
Absolutely. So talk a little bit about, you know, what is a passion that really drives you. You obviously are somebody who cares deeply about the Atlanta community, but in our earlier conversations, you also talked a little bit about, you know, other passions that you have. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me about transformational leaders is that there are, you know, what makes them truly inspiring is that they're very connected to their purpose and to their passion. So how would you articulate a sense of purpose or passion that you have?
I think my passion is to find, whether it's about the work that I do at the Community Foundation in Atlanta or about what my sort of long-term goals are for myself as a person, is about wanting to be connected to community and about wanting to see community change and about the connection to people. And for the long term, I am really, my goal in 10 years is to be able to retire and to be able to live and work in Guatemala. And so I have this whole game plan. It's kind of like the 3x5 card.
Yes,
to get back
yes.
to the 3x5 card.
So I want to see the latest 3x5 card.
And the latest 3x5 card says, we'll be fluent in Spanish. So I've been going for 5 years now to the Latin American Association every Saturday for 3 hours. Plus, I've done 2 intensive 2-week immersions in different parts of the world. So I'm working on that one. And the second one is that I have to want to be fit when I go there. So I do I train and do a sprint triathlon, which is the short triathlons, a sprint triathlon every year.
So tell me describe how many miles of each?
It's like 400 yards of swimming. It's a 17-mile bike ride. And then it's a 5K run.
Wow.
Which is plenty for me, let me tell you. Full triathlon people, that sounds like a walk in the park. To me, it still sounds like a whole hard thing every year. But it does. It's a good goal. It's a goal to have every year so that then I can be working towards the ultimate goal, which is being in good shape when I go to Guatemala. But I really, there's a particular community. I haven't been there yet, but I've been very close to it in the very northern part of Guatemala where most of the people who come to Atlanta come from. And that's the community. It's a bridge community, and it's a community that I'd love to see if there's a possibility of working in, and really being able to help, not to do for people, but to help them connect with whatever they want to be connected to and with, to be able to strengthen the economics of their community, because every person I've ever met here has said they wish they were back in Guatemala, and I completely understand that. It's just that they need to be able to live and survive. Mm-hmm. And so we need to help strengthen those communities too.
Mm-hmm. So why Guatemala and why that particular community? What has caught your fancy about that?
I went to Guatemala, I guess it was 6 years ago, with CARE and a group of women to look at some of the projects that CARE was doing in Guatemala. And not only did I fall in love with the whole concept of how they were working with women and girls in particular, because of the 10-year civil war in Guatemala, many men died, 200,000 men died. So the country is very much dominated by women working, and women working on farms, women working in lots of ways. So strengthening women and their economic capacity is a way to strengthen the country. And so I was very taken by that and by just the most wonderful people that you could possibly imagine meeting. And their desire for a better life for their children made me want to be able to be helpful to them. And to go to the community where the people come from Atlanta, I've met so many wonderful Guatemalans while I've been taking my Spanish lessons that it makes me want to work in the community that they come from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing. So how would you describe, given the sense of passion that you have, the desire to make impact for communities of people, how would you describe your personal brand?
That's an interesting one. I hope, I think it's committed.
Mm-hmm.
I think committed probably is more than anything, because no matter what it is, I try to really do very much research about something to mm-hmm. really make sure I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. And so once I'm committed to something, sharing that enthusiasm and sharing that data, knowledge, what's happening, the possibilities of something with people just becomes second nature.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it comes from the commitment to change mm-hmm. and that wanting to see that passion for change and mm-hmm. the passion that this can be better. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's really the desire and passion to impact, to make communities better, to really leave your mark.
Yes. And I don't think of it as leaving my mark. I mean, I don't really, honestly, I know that sounds trite and all that kind of stuff, but I just want this community to be a better place. I mm-hmm. really do.
Mm-hmm. So it's not about you. It's about the community.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. So talk about one of the things you talked about is commitment to change.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that is very unique about transformational leaders is that they are incredible change agents. Talk about perhaps some of your most, the kinds of changes that you've helped to bring about that you're most proud of. Either in some of your social work that you're involved in or certainly as part of the community foundation.
I think one of the changes, it's very interesting because I think there's two things that, I mean, I think the social business thing we're working on right now is one of those. That's sort of a looking ahead one.
The social entrepreneurship ventures.
Exactly.
Right.
But if we look back at what changes have happened, I think the two that I'm sort of proudest of. One is that the first grant that the Community Foundation made for AIDS HIV was in 1981 when the disease was still called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency.
Hmm.
It was before it was even named AIDS HIV.
Hmm.
And it was to the Atlanta Gay Center to help them work with the Fulton County Health Department on the particular needs of the population that was coming in to the health department. And that was a split vote by the board of directors of the Community Foundation. Mm. And Dan Sweat, who was the chair of the board at the time, made the tie-breaking vote.
Mm.
That was forward-thinking. And 20 years later, we have had 30 years later, we have had 30 years of grant-making for AIDS HIV in this community.
Mm.
And I think that's an important thing. The second one was...
Wait, stop there.
Oh, sorry.
What is it that makes that, meaningful for you? It's interesting
it's
to me that you...
Risk. It's taking risk. It's that taking risk. Everybody else was petrified to fund AIDS HIV or GRID before it because they were so afraid they'd be identified as gay, as homosexual, as maybe they had, maybe, all of the stuff, the social stuff around it that
mm-hmm.
was just...
Mm-hmm. The moral stuff as well.
Yes, all the moral stuff. People knew deep in their heart mm-hmm. something needed to be done, but fear.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the fact that the Community Foundation was able to overcome that fear, mm-hmm. to be an early leader, mm-hmm. and to be a consistent leader, mm-hmm. is important.
Well, particularly in a community like Atlanta, which is so southern and so conservative.
Exactly. So, in 1981.
Yeah. Woo! Yeah. So talk about, I think that's a fantastic example. So a big part of the Community Foundation, and it sounds like certainly you as a leader, is taking a stand for what's right, regardless of, you know, where the political winds are blowing.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So what was your role in driving that decision? And how did you go about it? Because the fact is that, you know, the world and certainly organizations need more leaders, more transformational leaders that really are willing to take a stand to do what is right.
We did have a very small staff at the time, so I actually did play a strong role in that grant, whereas I don't play as much a strong role now with grants that come before the Community Foundation, but at that point in time I did. And I did talk to various board members. I mean, I politicked it, and, mm-hmm. you know, really tried to work hard to help people understand. But I kept appealing to the fact that it was what was right and that it was what was needed and that the Community Foundation was the community's foundation, all of the community. Mm-hmm. And that even if people, board members or others, didn't feel like they could do it themselves, that they didn't feel like they wanted to make that grant, as a board member of the community's foundation, I mean, using mm-hmm. the different wording, mm-hmm. but, you
yes,
know,
yes.
they really needed to think about what the community needed. And it worked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's that appealing to a higher sort of authority or whatever.
Right, yeah. right. A sense of
yeah.
purpose
yes.
for the
yes.
other, for the organization
yes.
as well. So the politicking stuff worked.
Yes, it
yes.
did.
Yes.
It did. Well, it was.
And what have you learned about you yourself as an influencer? Because again, whether you work in nonprofit organizations or whether you work more and more so definitely in corporations, one of the skills that is incredibly important for transformational leaders is the ability to influence others over whom you have no direct authority hierarchically.
Exactly.
And certainly board members, you didn't, right?
Clearly, they could fire me.
Yes.
That kind of worked the
so
other
that was, that
way.
Was,
that kind of worked the
that
other
was a high-risk situation
high risk.
For you. So
very high risk.
Tell me a little bit about, maybe there's a lot of our listeners who want to clearly learn about influencing skills. So, you know, what have you learned about influencing skills?
You have to be fact-based. You have to know what you're talking about. You really do have to do the research to know what's happening, to know the details. Because if people can strip away that you really don't know what you're talking about, you completely lose the credibility you need to be able to do influencing.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, you've got to have your facts and your act together.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you need to figure out where they're coming from and what has been their life experience. What are going to be the things that they would raise as roadblocks or whatever that they would feel, and be prepared to deal with those. And I think it's just a matter of really sitting down and listening very carefully to what people's opposition to something is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know the answer to that they're raising, say, I don't know, but I'll get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then go do more research
mm-hmm.
and come back again and say, okay, I took what you said seriously. Here's what I found out.
Mm-hmm.
And just really keep trying to not knock it down, but work through each phase of opposition
mm-hmm.
piece by piece.
Mm-hmm. So I heard you say four things, right, in terms of what you've talked about in
okay.
terms of influencing. The first piece you talked about is get your facts, make
mm-hmm.
sure that you're credible in the information and knowledge you have about the subject.
Correct.
The second thing you talked about is get to know your audience. You know,
correct.
Who are the people that you're about to influence? What are going to be their barriers? What are going to be their energizers? What are going to be the enablers here? Get to know as much about them as you can. The third is about listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, listen deeply to their objections and really try to understand where they're coming from. And the fourth thing is be persistent.
Exactly. Don't give up.
Don't give up.
If you really believe in what you want to do, you got to have a thick skin. You can't just say, oh, they said no, and go run home with
yes.
your tail between
yes.
your legs.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Thank you for sharing that insight and wisdom. So let's talk about people. since you talked about, you know, the organization now is 30 mm-hmm. plus people in mm-hmm. the organization. And you said, you know, it's important that you continue to motivate them, that you know, there's lots of opportunities that they have probably for more money outside, but
Absolutely.
They're incredibly committed and motivated. Well, what is it that you do to rally people inside your organization?
What I hope I do, mm-hmm. because we all think sometimes we do more than what we actually do when it comes to all of that. And if you actually talk to my employees, you might get a different take. But I hope that it is understanding sort of where each of them are coming from and what they hope to get out of being at the Community Foundation and how they see themselves being able to contribute both in the short run and the long run, where they see themselves going. And, you know, within any organization, I'm sure it's easier if you have a very large organization like a Coca-Cola. People can move around to lots of different places. If you have 30 people, oftentimes there's not a lot of advancement opportunity, mm-hmm. which is really too bad.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am committed to with people who work for the Community Foundation, and I say this to them, particularly those coming in at an early level in their careers, you know, it's a first or second job, you know, they're really getting the grounding to be able to move up, and there's really not going to be much place for them to move up at the Community Foundation, is I say to them, if you stay 3 years, I will do everything in my power to help you find the next great job
mm-hmm.
and your next move.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't expect, they're not going to stay there forever, nor probably should they stay there forever if they're ambitious and they're looking. And I wish they could stay there forever, but I don't, you can't, you know, you mm-hmm. if there's nowhere to go, mm-hmm. you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that it's mentoring and helping people to see that they can have a vision that's greater than just this organization,
mm-hmm.
that they can take those skills and go out into the community in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so for the first, certainly you talked about, you know, the approach to leadership is one of mentoring and coaching and development and helping them carve out their unique path, whether that's within the organization or outside the organization,
correct.
which is obviously a critical trait of transformational leaders that helps them engage people, because you know, as a person working for somebody like that or working with somebody like that, that they truly care about you as the person as opposed to you as just the employee.
Right.
And so that's great. Talk a little bit about what truly inspires you. Who are the people that inspire you?
Mm.
What, you know, what are some of part of your core values that you hope to, you know, to continue to engage the people in the organization with?
It's interesting because what was the first thing that flashed through my head when you said that has nothing to do with work,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting. I have a 29-year-old and a 25-year-old, and they do inspire me.
Mm-hmm.
My kids actually inspire me
mm-hmm.
because I see in them, here are two young people living in Europe, never probably coming back to the United States. They see the world as a whole different place. The world is their oyster, not Atlanta, not even the United States. It's the world. And they see themselves as being one place today and probably in 5 years. You know, my son's in London. He might go to Indonesia. My daughter's in Portugal. She might go to Brazil. It's amazing. It's a different world. And I'm inspired by the vision, the broader vision that this next generation has. And I love, love, love to hang out with 20-some-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And so probably at least once or twice a month, I'm a guest lecturer for some class at Georgia State, Georgia Tech, University of Georgia, Emory, somewhere. Because I just get this like energy and this, I get fed
mm-hmm.
by talking to young people,
mm-hmm.
college and graduate
mm-hmm.
school, because the vision they have, the energy they have, the questions they ask.
Mm-hmm.
So I was telling you about the, mm-hmm. you know, wanting to go to Guatemala. I was teaching a Georgia State class and this guy in the back raises his hand and he says, Ms. Phillip, I don't mean to be rude in any way, he said, but do you really think you can go from telling everybody what to do here in Atlanta to being in a community where you really are just going to like help other people? And I went, Boy, is that the $64,000
question?
I said, I'm not really sure, but I'm really going to try and I'm going to test this out. I said, but boy, have you hit on the potential nightmare of this whole project. But that's the kind of honesty and insight that I get from being around people who, A, don't work for me. Do you know what I mean? And therefore can be much more honest.
Yeah.
And also just have a fresher worldview than those of us who've been around for a while.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you for sharing that story. You know, it always helps to hang around people who keep your ego in check.
Exactly.
For me, it's my cat, actually, and my 13-year-old daughter. That's great. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our audience that we haven't talked about? Are there any tips that you have in terms of your life lessons that you'd like to share?
The only thing that I would really want to share, thinking that probably many of your listeners are women, is the need to give back. And it doesn't only mean, yes, I think you ought to give your time, talent, and treasure to the community at large, but give it to the next generation of women too.
Mm-hmm.
And look at what the needs of women and girls are and how you can be a mentor, how you can be somebody they look up to. It's just really important.
Mm-hmm. Well, very wise parting words. I really, really enjoyed our time together. Thank you.
Thank
for
you.
Your time and for the opportunity to chat with you. And I'm looking forward to inviting you back when you get to the $1 billion.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thanks.
And this is your host, Hannah Anam, signing off. Join us again next week when we will have yet another transformational leader.